The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Listening to I Am Refocused Radio with your host, Shamaya Reed. This show is designed to inspire you to live your purpose and regain your focus. And now, here's your host, Shamaya Reed.
Hey, welcome to I Am Refocused Radio. We are here once again. And today, we have another amazing show lined up for y'all. We have our special guest. His name is Mark Stephen Pearl. He is a native New Jersey guy. But we're going to learn everything about his amazing story. He has a powerful story. And man, who doesn't love the mom? I know I love my mom. And man, this guy right here, he really loves his mom. And he has an amazing website you should check out. It's a cup of tea on the commode.org. And today we're going to be talking about his amazing book. But before we even do that, let's welcome Mark to the show. Say, first of all, how you doing today?
Hi, very well. Actually, I'm broadcasting from the south of France. And today, unfortunately, we have very London-like weather. It's cold and rainy. But well, normally, it's 300 days of sunshine, so I can't complain.
Well, I appreciate you making the time for us. And a little bit about you, if you will. Share a little bit about yourself with our audience, because you didn't just write an amazing book, but you also have an amazing career as well.
Well, I'm not so sure about amazing. Thank you for that. But so I grew up in New Jersey with, there were six of us, six kids. I'm the fifth out of the six. There's three boys, three girls. I'm the youngest son. And my parents were great. They're originally New Yorkers, and they moved to New Jersey. My dad was a chemist, so he worked for a couple of firms in New Jersey. My mother was a full-time proofreader for the Bergen Record, which at the time was the largest newspaper in New Jersey. And so we had a great upbringing in Ridgewood, New Jersey, which is, I guess, considered a suburb of New York City. It's about 20 miles outside New York City. And depending on traffic, you can get there anywhere within a half hour or 20 hours. But it was a great place because the village was, they called the Village of Ridgewood. It's very a nice, very good education system and really a cool place to grow up. And then you, a short distance away, you had the Center of Culture, and it was just fantastic. So I got exposed to a lot of really cool things, especially the arts, which were and still are a big part of my life. And that was, I think, attributed to my mother and her love of the arts. And so that was pretty cool. So that's it in a nutshell. I went to Ohio State and studied industrial design. And then I caught the acting bug, I think, from reliving some of my childhood exposure to the arts. And I went out to Hollywood for 28 years and did the Hollywood thing, which I had pretty good success for a while. And then as time goes on, you age out unless you've got a really good career going. At that time, I had an okay career, but things started slowing down. But while I was there, it was very inspirational. I think my parents kind of put this in us too, because we all worked as kids and we all owned our own companies eventually as we got older. And so one of my adventures was I invented a snack food, or I started a snack food company with my brother to honor my dad and his half pop popcorn snack he invented in the early 60s. And it was kind of like a family secret. And to honor him and his memory, because he passed before we were actually in the stores, we created this product, which we called the Grandpa Poe's Originals, and it became a national brand for a while. It was the snack of the day on Rachel Ray, and it was really good fun, a lot of work. I built a nice factory out in L.A., and it was an organic snack, and we were riding that new wave. And then the subject of the book is in 2012, we got a call from my brother, who said my mother just shut down. She was living in the house we all grew up in Ridgewood, and she seemed to be somewhat depressed and wanted to check out. So we all flew in, and we were pretty much on death watch because her doctor cut off all meds and food, and hospice was called. And usually when hospice is called, the end is not such a happy one. So that was a big deal. So that's how the book opens, with that call. And so I changed my life, because I was at that time I was 55 and I was a carefree bachelor living in LA, having a good time. No steady girlfriend, no children, never was married. And my only obligations really was to my business. And so this call kind of changed everything. And I flew back home and stayed with her for several weeks. And then she snapped out of it, which was great. But I realized that she really wanted and needed, I think, love to be in that house again. That we had some people that moved in that were overseeing the household duties and things, and cooking and stuff for my mom. She could still walk and do things. But after this episode, she was bedridden. And that was pretty much it. But once she snapped out of it, then I started thinking, okay, I need to do something because my mother deserves better. And that's what the book's about.
We're talking to our guest today, Mark Stephen Pearl, and his book, A Cup of Tea on the Commode. Talk about the call, because when you started to rush to back to New Jersey and find yourself by your mom's bedside, caring for your mother, what was going through your mind? Were you just saying, boom, got to get up and go? How were you reacting to that call?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I grew up in a very nurturing family, and family was number one. So 14 years earlier, I got a call, similar call, about my dad. And my brother, the same brother, had to make those calls, which are not easy. And he said, Dad has 30 days. And I flew in the next day. It's just what I do anyway. And with my mom, we didn't know how long it was going to be. And so there's no question. You get on a plane and you go. And then once I got there, she was in I called it a semi-comatose state. So she didn't open her eyes. Once in a while, she did open her eyes and looked at the corner of the room, which was very interesting. And I have a chapter about that. But she didn't talk, and she didn't really acknowledge any of us, other than she was very responsive to touch, which was nice. And so one of us slept in the bed with her just to be close, just in case she needed something. And my younger sister and I hung out with hospice. Hospice was there all the time. They were great. And but we wanted to care for our mother as much as possible. So we learned. We were really good students. We learned whatever we could to learn how to change the diapers. And an adult, it's everything's a little bit different. Changing the bed while a helpless patient is lying in bed. Certain techniques of washing and how to care for a fragile older person. At this time, my mother was 89. She just turned 89. And so it was good to do that. And I think my mom sensed that we were there. And then when she snapped out of it, whenever hospice was there less and less, my sister and I took over. And then when my younger sister went back to Michigan to her family, I stayed on for a number of more weeks and took over. And it was great because a little awkward, I think, because it's very rare for a son to take on the caregiving duties. And at that point, I wasn't 24/7. By the end of the year, I kind of did fill that spot. And but it was a little bit of an adjustment because you're seeing your mother for the first time, at least for me, naked. And you're seeing what all those years have done to her body. And this is where I think some of my design and acting experience came in, because I assumed the role of the caregiver and got over the personal relationship as best I could and said, I've got a job to do. So I'm going to assume this role and do it as best as possible. But, you know, she's still my mother. I will ask permission for various things. And when I did ask her if she wanted me to really move back and take over everything, She said, yes. And I said, well, if I do that, two things. First of all, we will have fun. Second of all, that means I'm in charge. And her mood completely changed. And then she puckered up for a kiss. She was I called her a little bit of a kissing bandit. And I wasn't sure if that puckering up was a sign of surrender or one wishing me luck. And so I gave her a kiss and hoped for the best, because she could be a tough cookie.
And with the knowledge of understanding that you became your mother's primary caregiver, and you just mentioned getting her blessing to be the one to step up for the challenge and be with her, what was it like to have that balance between being the one in charge to oversee her care, but also maintaining respect for the dignity of your mom?
I don't know. I think for me, it was pretty easy because she is at that point pretty much a child and completely dependent on whoever was in the room caring for her. And she seemed to be quite content with whoever, because unlike my dad wanted to maintain his dignity until the end and rarely asked for help. We knew when he needed it and we would jump in. But with my mom, she was like, you know, she's almost like the queen. Go ahead, take care of it. You're now my servant. So that was a little interesting. And sometimes she took it a little too far. But usually she had a good sense of humor. My dad did as well. And I luckily inherited some of those genes. So humor played a major role in it. But I think with that role, even if it's not your mother, maintaining that respect for that person and if not maintaining their dignity, restoring their dignity, because at that point, I think my mother lost some of her dignity. So I did some things to boost her spirits. One of the first things I did is I bought her a new wardrobe, because these old day dresses and were tattered and they looked like old person's clothes. And I didn't want my mom looking like that. I wanted her to look her best and feel her best. That was an awkward thing for a middle-aged man going out looking for senior citizens' clothing and stuff. That was kind of fun. But then I also created a thing called Day of Beauty. And my mother worked full-time and had six kids, but she treated herself once a week to the beauty parlor, where she got a shampoo and set and had her nails done. She had gorgeous nails. She was a nail model in her teens, early 20s. So she had gorgeous nails. So she always took care of those, which were a miracle, raising six kids. So I wanted to recreate that for her at home, because I don't know the last time she went to the beauty parlor or was ever really cared for, treated like a beautiful woman. And so I would... when she was sitting on the commode, I would soak her feet in Epsom salts. I would wash and shampoo and rinse her hair. And then she got a full body massage with lotion. And then I tended to any medical needs she needed. And then she picked out her wardrobe. And then I blow dried her hair and ponytailed it, or sometimes even gave it a braid. And then I did her nails. And then finished it off with some nice bright red lipstick to match her nails. And I didn't think that much of it. I just thought this is something she would like. And then the first day I did it, I was wheeling her from, at that point, again, she was bedridden. So I would carry her into the wheelchair and then take her into the kitchen for breakfast. We had a large dining room table. I mean, a mirror in the dining room. And I parked her in front of that, and she just beamed. And I leaned in cheek to cheek with her, and I said, who is that pretty girl? And she smiled, and it was just gorgeous. The effect on her, and certainly on me as well, was just profound. And then, so I kept doing this with her, because everybody, her excitement and contentment with this thing, I think, just kind of radiated. So whoever saw her after that said, oh my gosh, you look great. So the wardrobe and the Day of Beauty had a huge impact. And so I maintained that. Our journey, I say, lasted 3.5 years. And so I kept this up because of the beautiful effect it had on her.
When you look back, what lessons do you believe you learned about the importance of the small gestures that you created with acts of kindness and providing her the best care possible while you had the time left with her?
Well, I have to say, because at that point, not having children and not being married and stuff, unconditional love was something I was probably still grappling with. So I definitely learned unconditional love, because it was my MO at that time was I would do things. I would jump in with full gusto and then get bored or accomplish what I wanted to accomplish and then move on to the next thing. Well, with my mother, I was not moving on until she wanted to move on. So I had to learn, no matter what the mental, physical, or emotional stress you're going through, it's the job that I took on. And so I not only had to make sure mom trusted me, but I had five siblings that I had to deal with that allowed me to take this on. So I didn't want to disappoint anybody. So definitely unconditional love was something I learned, and patience. And being a parent, boy, there's times where you know you just love them to death, and there's other times where you want to kill them, because they can be stubborn and just a real pain in the neck. And my mother was very independent, and she was a guilt tripper, but funny. So I had to deal with all that stuff. And there was times where, you know, it wasn't a perfect thing. I blew my top occasionally but you get over it. And luckily she was very forgiving. But I'd say probably the main thing for me was empathy. And I think for anybody in that position, because you really have to put yourself in their shoes. They are still, a person. They still deserve respect and dignity. They have a lot of wisdom, and they deserve love. And if another thing that I learned is wanting to feel pretty doesn't end at 90 years old. And if you really tune into what you think they need, and then also you can ask, there's a nice dialogue going on. You ask, hey, would you like to have your hair washed today? Would you like some makeup? It was just a very cool I think time that we had together, and a lot of that came out of how I was raised. And so it didn't seem to be that big of a deal. I mean, it ended up being a lovely experience, certainly for me. And then when I shared my story early on with other friends who were going through this, because especially as baby boomers, we're all dealing with this. And it's a phenomenon that's just going to get worse and worse, or better and better, depending on how you look at it, because we're all living longer, and this is going to become a crisis if we don't handle it the right way. And I'm hoping to inspire other people to handle it the way I did, because it was rewarding for me, certainly rewarding for my mom and for my siblings. And then as I shared my story, people really got some inspiration and some tips, because I don't say it's a how-to book, because it is a memoir with some lovely stories, but it's a what I did book. And there are some, I think, some really good tips in there that people have certainly benefited from. You know, when I see my mom and the look on her face, even in those very frustrating days, when you see her smile or pucker up for a kiss or give me a witty comeback to something I said, that's all the, I think, payback or joy you needed to know that you're doing the right thing. And so it was, I think, it might have been more rewarding for me than it was for my mom.
We're talking to Mark Stephen Pearl and about his mom and the book that he wrote in honor of her. A cup of tea on thecomo.org is the website you can go to. When you see through the lens of your mother, the role is reversed. At one point in time, she took care of you. And then at another set of time, you start to take care of her. What is something that you appreciate the most during the process of learning of the power of just being there with your mom, knowing that she knows that you haven't forgotten her?
Well, there was I guess one incident that kind of brings that into focus. There was one day we really had a tough time. She had a tough time, and I got very frustrated with her. And she looked at me, and she said, "Why are you so good to me?" And I said, "Because you're my mother, and you deserve to be loved. And it's an honor for a son to take care of his mother." And she was shocked. And she said, "It is?" And I had to convince her that this was very important, because, you know, I did say, you know, "How long did you take care of us?" I mean, it's 18 years, sometimes a lot longer, but for all of us, we all left, you know, to go to college at 18. So that was it. But my gosh, it did take some convincing, because she actually felt guilty. And it hurt me that she felt guilty. So after I convinced her, and certainly by my actions convinced her, it was, let's say the realization of the complete role reversal. And, you know, you accept your parents, I guess, whether you like it or not, they're your parents, and you accept that they are in charge, or they should be for a certain period of time. And she kind of let me take over at that point. And so that was a very important moment.
People listen to this right now, and maybe they are finding themselves or someone that they know unexpectedly thrust into the role of becoming a caregiver for their aging parent. Based on your experience, what words of wisdom would you give to that person in order for them to see the bigger picture in the responsibility of taking care of their aging parent?
Well, I think the first thing and most important is to be there. If and in any role that you can, if you're present, that's lovely. If you're present and actually doing some of the work, not everybody is cut out for that. Even in my own family, there were siblings that just were hands off. They did other things to help out with the house and making. One sister did a lot of cooking when she came to visit, and she made blankets and brought little mother love little stuffed toys. Anything with an animal was great. She was a big animal lover. And so take whatever role you're comfortable with, because if you're uncomfortable, they will sense that, you know. And then I was fortunate to have hospice there for a number of months, and I learned from the pros as best I could. So there are certain things, if you're going to take on more, learn how to do it correctly, because if you go in and you're not ready or trained, it'll be frustrating for both of you, and also could be dangerous for your loved one. So I would say that is probably the most important thing. But if you're just there, I mean, some of the best moments that we had was just sitting at the kitchen table holding hands, not saying a word. She had the gift of gab most of her life, but on these last few years, she had very little things, didn't say a lot. But she, like I said earlier, she responded to touch. And those were beautiful moments, because you knew there was a lot of love going on between those hands. So I would say, I hope that answers your question. But, you know, being there, I think, is the most important. And then take as much responsibility on as you feel comfortable doing, and certainly qualified to be doing. So
last question for you. You mentioned hospice. With their experience, what would you say is a good balance to allow them to do their part, but know when is the right time to step up, step in, and kind of intervene, if you will, to make sure that the quality of the care is being executed?
Well, we were lucky. I think all of the hospice nurses were quite good, and all they do their own thing. We had a number of them that broke the rules, because at that point, mom was off meds, off food. They said, give ice chips if she needs a little moisture on her lips. But that's it. And we had one hospice nurse that there was a directive. We didn't do this, but my younger sister and I were there all the time when hospice was there. And we never stepped in to do anything that they were supposed to do. We observed and learned what we could, and we asked. They seemed to be happy that we were interested and wanted to learn. So not one of them said anything like, you know, get out of my way, I've got work to do. They were all very helpful. And but this one nurse looked at the directive. It said no food, no drinks, and no getting out of bed and stuff like that. And she went right into my mother and asked her if she was hungry. Now, my mother's eyes were closed for several weeks. Her eyes shot open like the dinner bell rang. And then this nurse accused us of trying to starve our mother to death, which I think in some cases may happen, you know, with the kids. But we loved our mother. We certainly weren't. We were listening to the hospice rules. So hospice doesn't always get it right. So at that point, I certainly felt really guilty. And after we had to get that nurse out of the house because her supervisor even said, you broke the rules, you need to leave. So before they sent another nurse in, I went and asked my mom if she was in fact hungry. And she said, well, what do you got? And this is, again, her first words in weeks. And I said, anything you want. At this point, it was March. So it had been about maybe 3 or 4 weeks since she had any food. And she said, how about some pumpkin pie? And I said, well, okay, it's March. It's not really pumpkin pie season. But my brother, who lived locally, was in the living room, and I asked him to go out and take a look. So he took on the challenge, and he came back with two pumpkin pies. And those pumpkin pies were like miracle workers. She woke right up, and she downed half the pie the first day, downed the half a pie the second day, and then a full pie the next day. But and she snapped out of it, and that she was back, and she recognized all of us, and I think we were off to the races because she's like, okay, my kids are here, life is good again. I'm gonna be here for a while, which was great. So, not everybody follows the rules, and in this case, this particular nurse actually did us a favor.
Once again, listen on Refocus Radio, talking to our guest, Mark Stephen Pearl. You can get his book, A Cup of Tea, on the commode. You can go to his website, acupoftheacommode.org. First and foremost, I want to say thank you for what you did for your mom. I think that's commendable. I think that's powerful. And it says a lot about your heart. And hopefully someone listening will be inspired to do the same for their parents. Once again, I want to say thank you, Mark, for your time.
I appreciate it, Shamaya. Thank you very much. It was a great to... every time I get to share my mom's story, I keep her in the present, which is a beautiful gift for me. So I very much appreciate it.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.